Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, Jonathan Gold takes us out for some ceviche. We'll cool off with an iced coffee and some gazpacho. I show you some innovative ways to grow food in small places. Plus, Deep End diner Eddie Lim discovers a new cuisine on a trip to Taiwan. And rethinking Pad Thai. But first, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week with Market Manager Laura Avery.
It's always good to have information about what we're tasting and eating at the farmers market and to help us navigate our way through the myriad offerings. We're so happy to have David Karp here at the market. He's been away for a week doing research. He's back. And David, what have you got? You're talking about interspecific pluots. What is that?
Interspecific stone fruit, that means a combination between different species. They're all Prunus, that is in the genus, they're stone fruit. And that means that they can be hybridized, but it's difficult to do so, and it's taken the Zegers, who created the pluots, 45 years to come up with some of the interspecific hybrids we're just starting to see now.
So a pluot is itself an interspecific hybrid of?
Of plum and apricot. It's more plum, and both in its genes and its characteristics, than apricot. We're now familiar with apriums, which are the reverse, more apricot than plum. When I was up in the Zegers, the breeders of the pluots, just last week, they were showing me, in some cases, fruits that had five different fruits in them. Plum, peach, cherry, nectarine, apricot, all together. Wow. What are you going to call this?
Okay, now this looks like a perfect heart-shaped plum with a very pointy end.
That's a plary. It's a a plum and cherry mixed together. The idea being that the cherry lends to the plum high sugar and the intense flavor you get from cherries. If you go to, well, Fitz should have next Wednesday, he should have something he calls Mr. McNulty. It's a nectar plum, which is a nectarine and plum. There are a number of growers in farmers markets that have Dapplefire, nominally a pluot, but it's actually a nectocotum.
Nectarine, apricot, plum.
Exactly.
Wow. What are we getting at the market that is something, that one of these interspecific things we can taste?
I noticed that Scott and Baldrama both have Flavor King pluot, which is probably the most delicious of all pluots.
One of my favorites.
It's hard to grow, and farmers have been abandoning it, but it's got a gum pocket. It cracks and splits. They fall off the tree. There's everything wrong except the flavor.
Yeah, right.
They got to be pretty darn ripe to have that fantastic flavor. When they do, it's really, really rich. It was aptly named, unlike a lot of these pluots.
Okay, and now the pluots that I am familiar with here, they're going to be in pretty much throughout the summer, on and off, so we will start seeing more and more of them, so it's a matter of just finding a good one, but I agree with you, the Flavor King is outstanding.
There's at least three dozen varieties of pluots that have been released commercially, and more of them are showing up at farmers' markets, yes.
So when are we going to get a plary?
Well, there's one guy that planted 10 acres of those, Jeff Spomer, in Kingsburg just a little while ago. I think we will be seeing more of them. A lot of people think, hybrid. And they frown on that as if it's something that's genetically modified, which it isn't. These are all obtained via conventional breeding.
Okay. Well, David, this is so fascinating. And thanks to you for being the one who is out there doing the research, bringing us the information. And we're actually going to get to taste one of these plaries
now. All right.
All right. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Laura. Always a pleasure.
It's delightful to try different recipes using interesting and unique herbs here from the farmers market. And Nancy Zaslavsky is an expert on Mexican cooking. She takes cooking tours to Oaxaca. She is going to share a recipe with us today for a pit roasted Mexican dish called barbacoa.
That's right, Laura. Barbacoa is traditionally cooked underground, especially in the central states, and my favorite is in Oaxaca. The specialty herb that's used are avocado leaves, and they use a specific type of leaf that's very, very anisey flavor. There are different kinds of avocados, and I have one right here from the Coleman family ranch.
And that's a big leaf. That's about 6 inches long. Do you know if this is a Hass or a Fuerte, or doesn't it matter what variety of avocado
it is? I don't think it matters too much, as long as you use one that's very aromatic. And the ones that are at Coleman's stand are great, because that's what I always use.
They're fresh.
They're fresh, and they smell great.
Right.
And, of course, it's the toasted chilies, because it is a chili broth. I always make barbacoa with lamb. What I do is I get guajillo chilies.
Fresh or dried?
These are dried chilies. They're long, dark red, cordovan color, about 6 inches long or so. And I cut the chili stem off, slit it down the center, scrape out the seeds. And then I toast them on a griddle with a spatula pressing down. And as soon as the color changes, I turn them over and plop them in a saucepan full of water, hot water, turn the heat up, boil it, turn the heat off, and let it soak for 20 minutes. And then I toast the avocado leaves right on the same griddle. Same way. Just put them all on the griddle, turn them over, let them get a little bit brown. And I get a white onion. I cut it in quarters, put it up, toast it on the griddle, and the garlic cloves, probably like a whole head of garlic, and I break it up into cloves, toast that until it's black all over.
You skin it?
After. And then I put the chilies, the leaves, the onion, garlic, and some salt and pepper in a blender. And I add 1 cup of water, and I blend everything. And then to get it smooth, you have to put it through a sieve. Mm. And then, rather than digging a pit, I use a Dutch oven, like a Le Creuset type of heavy pot or a big stainless steel heavy pot. And I line the bottom of the pot with about a dozen avocado leaves.
Toasted?
These are the toasted ones, yep. And then I put the meat right on top of it. And I lay 2 sprigs of epazote. And epazote is another herb that is from central and southern Mexico that I get it also at the Coleman Farm stand here. And then you sprinkle it with dried Mexican oregano. And then you top the whole thing with the remaining avocado leaves, like another dozen or so, and put in 8 cups of water. So 2 quarts of water, and you cover it with a tight lid, pop it into the oven. Now, this is going to take a long, slow cooking. I cook mine at 350 for 5 to 6 hours. But it's like cooking in a pit underground. And then when you take it out and lift the lid, oh, my God, the perfume that comes out and fills your kitchen is crazy. You serve it in large chunks and on a platter, and you sprinkle it with a little bit sea salt. And then you skim the fat off of the top of the broth and serve the broth in little cups on the side. And serve it with corn tortillas, of course. They make luscious tacos with a really nice table salsa. And there you go. That's barbacoa, the real deal.
All right, Nancy. Well, thanks so much. That's a wonderful recipe. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Laura.
That was Nancy Zaslavsky with a real look at not only into the heart and soul of Oaxaca, but also what makes this market so great and what inspires us every week to keep coming back. I just want to give everybody a bee update. Last week, we did have a bee swarm here at the market, and we were upset that it looked like the bee swarm was being decimated through a sticky trap. Turns out I did check with Animal Control, who told me that they had contacted Vector Control. And what happens is when a resident in Santa Monica, anyway, calls about a bee swarm, they Vector Control will come out. Now, they will do everything they can to save the hive. These hives are valuable. What they did with this hive last week, they did smoke the hive to render the bees docile. They captured them, including the queen, and then they transported the hive to a safe location. I'm not sure where. The bees we saw that were kind of buzzing around this trap were the ones that were left after the queen had been removed. Now, these bees did not have a chance of survival without their queen anyway, and this was the last few hundred stragglers who were then caught in the sticky trap and destroyed. So, kind of a bittersweet ending, but people should know that Vector Control does save as many hives as possible. They will be called. They will come and help you out. Our beekeepers here at the market also are available. Often they're not available the minute you call, but if you do call them and you want to reach them, they will do their best to come out and save that hive. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures and recipes from the Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can download the PieCast there, too. It's a weekly bonus podcast all about pie. This week, Valerie Gordon of Valerie Confections shares her recipe for fresh fruit galettes. Check out the Good Food blog to see pies from some of my favorite bakers, bloggers, and food writers. It's all part of the Pie A Day project, which culminates with the second annual Good Food Pie Contest, Labor Day weekend in Beverly Hills. Details or at kcrw.com/pie. When most people travel, enjoying the local cuisine is part of the adventure. But as always, nothing is typical, even on vacation, for Deep End diner Eddie Lin.
Yes, I was very recently in Taiwan for a family trip. And of course, while I was there, my family made sure I ate very well. And I was introduced to actually cuisine that I've never heard of or knew about.
Really?
Yes. Specifically, it's Taiwanese Aboriginal cuisine.
Now, what would that mean, Aboriginal?
Aboriginal, basically, as the word means, are the original inhabitants of Taiwan. And those people are technically Austronesians who are related to other Austronesians like Filipinos, Malaysians, and Indonesians. And they lived there at least 8,000 years before the Han Chinese immigrated around the 17th century. And what Aboriginal Taiwanese cuisine specializes in are basically what's available around them. They tend to live in the mountains, in the mountain regions. And so there's a lot of rustic flavors, fresh ingredients, wild game like boar, partridge, a lot of wild herbs, vegetables, and mushrooms. And they really enjoy millet.
That's so interesting.
And actually, millet was consumed before the Han Chinese came over and introduced rice. So now rice is kind of taking over where millet left off.
So describe some of the dishes you had. How was millet used?
Well, millet was used basically in stir fries. It's kind of just worked into the food. And it's also worked into the meats, too. It's just kind of this thing that's kind of a filler, kind of a carb that they enjoy, you know, with their food. But other ways of using millet is definitely in the alcohol, in this kind of rice wine or a liquor. And it's really potent. And the way I had it was in a kind of a sangria form. It was chilled in ice and there were slices of citrus in the drink. It was like a moonshine because it's more of a whole grain. It has that kind of flavor to it. And it's really, really potent.
Share with us some of the dishes that you had that you'd never experienced before.
Oh, there were plenty of it. One of the standouts was betel nut. Before I ever went to Taiwan, I've heard about the legendary betel nut, and I know it's very popular in Asia and Southeast Asia, and it's apparently a very powerful stimulant. It looks like a very fresh nut, meaning that it's green, and then it's cracked open, and some kind of paste is put on it, or a tobacco leaf is wrapped around it. I was offered one at dinner, at this Aboriginal Taiwanese dinner, and I was really excited. I had one, and I'm telling you, the effects happen almost instantly. Your heart starts racing. You know, you start to feel more alert. And at this point, when I had the betel nut, I was already pretty, you know, sauced. I had a lot of this Taiwan beer and a lot of the millet. and this betel nut just completely cleared my senses. I was almost sober again. My vision was clear. My head was clear. And I was ready to go. You know, it was pretty intense. But other things I had, as far as meats, there's a lot of it. And I had wild boar sausages and short ribs that were basically grilled. And I had dulkuk. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but dulkuk, which is a mountain chicken soup, which was basically like a normal chicken soup, except there was also wild mushrooms and wild plants in the soup. So it was really nice. I had rooster testicles with ginger and garlic, which is a pretty common preparation for the Taiwanese Aboriginals. There's pickled flying squirrel intestines.
Not just pickled flying squirrel, but pickled flying squirrel intestines.
Correct. And then there's grilled mountain rat.
I'm sorry. Well, it's like, it's to me, it's sort of funny that a rat has a different appellation.
Well, yeah. I mean, come on. There's a lot of rats.
Yes, you know, I'm like sure.
Country mouse and city mouse.
Right.
But that's only the beginning. There's some insane things that I swear I thought someone was just making this stuff up just to impress me. But they have something called stinky meat, which is a wild boar or some kind of game that's been kind of left to rot until, you know, maggots start to infest it. And then they proceed, when it's ripe, quote, they proceed to barbecue and then fry it up with ginger and garlic and serve it that way. There's even a crazier one, which is dubbed maggot boar. And they kill a boar, hang it from a tree, wait 3 days when it's crawling with maggots. They put a pot of hot oil under the pig. The maggots drop into the hot oil. Of course, they get fried. They're, you know, taken out of it and then eaten like a snack.
For people who are living on the edge in terms of survival, that's sort of brilliant.
Right.
It's really efficient.
I mean, you're creating another source of protein.
Right. Horrifying, but another source of protein.
Yeah.
Did you taste that?
No, I was invited to, but then I found out that they wouldn't let people who they didn't know partake because there's been kind of a crackdown
right.
by the officials.
In addition to this really interesting, super authentic experience you had, you also had another really weird experience that you're kind of viewing through the lens of conspiracy theory.
Yes, I made this kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek post on my blog about the BK7 layer hamburger. And I kept seeing this commercial over and over again. I swear, every commercial break, they would show this Burger King ad, a Chinese one, and it just showed this enormous 7-patty, 7-cheese topped with bacon hamburger. At first, I was just laughing at it. And then, because they played it so often, I guess it worked. I guess the ad worked, and I had to have one. So I went to the closest Burger King in Taiwan, and I ordered one. And it is just this enormous beast of a burger, and it's, I don't know how many calories. I mean, I'm sure it's a full day's worth.
7 patties, and each patty has cheese on it.
And bacon topped off.
I have to tell you, it isn't the bacon that worries me. So first of all, could you get it into your mouth?
Yeah, yeah. You can actually kind of squish it down a little and make all the patty and cheese kind of fuse together. And that's actually the best part of it, you know. I wasn't sure how I was going to like it, but then I took one bite and it just won me over and I was part of the conspiracy. It worked. This conspiracy to fatten up, and that was part of my joke. This is a conspiracy by who knows who to fatten up the skinny Taiwanese, and I fell victim to that. And man, I had to roll out of there and then go to my next meal, which was a beef noodles soup.
That probably settled your stomach a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
Eddie, as always, it's fascinating talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Eddie Lin writes the blog Deep End Dining. See a picture of the 7-patty Burger King cheeseburger that Eddie had in Taiwan. It's at kcrw.com/goodfood. And boy, is it a mouthful. I'm joined now in the studio with Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly. Each week, he takes us on a trip of sorts to a different neighborhood in Los Angeles. Jonathan, where are we headed today?
We are headed to what is quaintly known as the Byzantine Latino District.
And where are we going in the Byzantine Latino District?
We are going to the Latino half of the equation, specifically a restaurant called La Cevicheria.
So does that mean they serve a lot of ceviche?
You would be correct.
I love when the title gives it all away.
Wouldn't it be horrible if it were called La Cevicheria and they had absolutely no ceviche at all?
It'd be pretty funny. Okay, so let us go back to ceviche. Ceviche has so many different varieties. What makes this particular place special?
This place is special because, and I know this sounds like really facetious, but the ceviches taste really, really good. You go to a Peruvian place and they'll have like a specific Peruvian ceviche and that will be, you know, tasty. It'll be specific. It'll be culturally appropriate. Or you get a Mexican ceviche and the same thing. The guys who own this are Guatemalan. And as far as I know, there's no huge Guatemalan ceviche tradition. I have three Guatemalan cookbooks and there's not a single ceviche recipe in any of them. But nonetheless, there they are making ceviche. Actually, the Guatemalan ceviche is, for some reason, the best one of them all. It has, you know, bits of octopus in it. It has bits of fish in it. It has bits of shrimp in it. It has, oddly enough, well, not oddly enough for a ceviche, but oddly enough for a ceviche that I would actually take a second bite of, artificial crab, which doesn't seem to hurt it at all. And it's mixed together with the citrus juices of, I think, a healthy slug of what must be Worcestershire sauce and mint leaves.
Wow.
Which is a herb I'd never thought of in conjunction with ceviche before. And it is totally compelling. It is a giant sort of goblet of fish. And you will finish that giant goblet of fish.
That's really interesting because when I think of Worcestershire sauce, which has an alchemy that is often underappreciated. It has a lot of tamarind in it. And so if you think of tamarind and mint together, they go pretty well together.
Not a bad combination.
Yeah.
And Worcestershire sauce gives it that hit of pure umami also, which is so important, as we know. You could eat it in what's apparently the Central American way, which is with saltines. Or the Mexican manner, which is piled on top of tostadas, fried tortillas.
Is this the place where you had the encounter with the bloody clams?
This is. This is Bloody Clam Central.
Now, what is a bloody clam?
A bloody clam is, I think, a Pacific clam. I mean, I first encountered them, you know, decades ago in, you know, Ensenada, where you buy them on the corners. They call them patas de mula, you know, mule's feet. In Mexico and Ensenada, you get them in sort of a cocktail. Here, you also can get them in a cocktail. You can get them on the half shell. But as a ceviche, it's compelling. They're dark. They're sort of strong tasting. They're big for clams. And the juice is black, almost like jet black with like little traces of blood red in it, you know, thence the bloody clam, I think.
It's like a true blood ceviche.
It's a true blood ceviche. I actually think it's kind of goth looking.
How funny.
You know, we chopped up with a bunch of stuff. It becomes somehow more than it is when you eat one on a half shell. You usually, you know, as we all know, shellfish is better just by itself or maybe with a couple of drops of lemon juice max. But with bloody clams, apparently more is more. I was in the restaurant one time when what I imagine is their bloody clam purveyor came in, which is this tiny, squat Guatemalan woman carrying like boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes. I mean, they were much taller than she was. And you could just tell that they were the bloody clam boxes. And the energy, I mean, it almost made you want to like lay your hands on them to get some of that gothic bloody clam energy that was emanating from those boxes. It was really compelling.
What other kinds of ceviches are there at La Cevicheria?
You can get a shrimp ceviche. It's a nice shrimp ceviche. It's not the most unusual thing you've ever had in your life. And you can get, you know, sort of all the usual octopus ceviches and things like that. I think most people tend to go for either the bloody clams or for the full-on Guatemalan ceviche. And they also have cooked foods. People usually get one cooked dish for the table and maybe a couple of ceviches for the table. The portions are huge and they almost refuse to sell you more than you're going to eat. But the thing that seems to be most popular is a mariscada, which is, if you were going to be honest about it, probably the same thing as ceviche, except sautéed instead of made into a ceviche. But it's, you know, all these kinds of seafood that are briefly sautéed and then sort of simmered for a minute in one of a number of sauces they have. Probably the best one is what they call the Caribbean mariscada, which is flavored with habanero.
Hmm. Now, are the sauces inflected with citrus juices?
They're not. It's a really sort of straightforward sauce. It would almost not make sense to go to La Ceviceria for anything but ceviches and maybe a mariscada, and it's pretty much BYOB. If not, they have a really good house limeade. And tres leches cake for dessert. Simple.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
We've been talking about La Ceviceria on Pico between Arlington and Crenshaw. Get a text message with the exact address and receive a text each week with the new restaurant info. Text Good Food to 69866. That's Good Food to 69866. All of Jonathan Gold's restaurant suggestions are on the Good Food restaurant map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'd love to know if you've tried any of Jonathan's recommendations. If so, leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. And check out the profile of Jonathan in this month's LA Times magazine. I've got a link to the piece on our blog. Starting this Monday, I'll be partnering with Bill Esparza of StreetGourmetLA.com to bring street food indoors for a night. Our first Monday night pop-up will feature Ricky's Fish Tacos. For more information, go to AngeliCafe.com. That's AngeliCafe with two Fs, .com. Up next, Chef Jet Tila takes a second look at Pad Thai. You're listening to Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Sometimes a particular ethnic cuisine becomes so associated with a dish that that dish ends up defining the cuisine. Take pizza, for example. For a long time, pizza defined Italian cuisine in America. Thankfully, that era is long over. Jet Tila, the executive chef at Wazuzu in Las Vegas, is currently peeved at Pad Thai.
So it's what everyone dubs as the quintessential Thai dish. It's rice noodles, primarily flavored with, you know, that whole yum, the tamarind, the fish sauce, lime juice, and if made correctly, a dash of sriracha, real sriracha, not the rooster sriracha, the Thai sriracha. So it's sweet, it should be a little sour, it should be squishy, it's got that nice kind of mouthfeel. That's good Pad Thai.
In Thailand, is it the marquee dish?
You know, it's street food. It's common fare. And you know, if you think about Pad Thai, it's noodles. So it's Chinese, right? I mean, it's what our Chinese grandmothers gave us, and now it's claimed to be the all-knowing, you know, mega Thai dish that really personifies the cuisine, I guess.
But the reason people love it so much, the reason Americans love it so much, is that the first wave of Thai immigrant cooks who made it really sweet.
And, you know, it's actually, you're absolutely right. So the 60s and 70s, Pad Thai came to America and turned this nuclear orange color, which it isn't in Thailand, by the way. Actually, it is now. And so something's happened in the last 20 years. The sweet and the orange has traveled back to Thailand.
You're kidding me.
No. So I was in like the most remote shopping, you know, village where, you know, you have mounds of fish that are in the sun and meat in the sun. And there's just a little vendor guy serving Pad Thai. And it was nuclear orange, peppered with paprika, and it was sweet, like sticky sweet.
How sad!
I know. I think that's what started it. That's what started it. I was in Thailand, you know, like 6 months ago, and I came back, and I'm like, is it chicken or egg? You know, was it... what happened to Pad Thai? I used to be able to go home to Thailand and find my Pad Thai, the Pad Thai that my grandma used to make, and it's all sticky sweet now, and that's why I'm not happy about it.
So you mentioned paprika. How did paprika, which I don't think of when I think of Thai spices.
I mean, we think a new world, right? Paprika,
yeah,
right?
Right.
So okay, so this is how it happened. So, you know, my parents, that first group cooks pad thai, hits it with sriracha sauce, sends it out. It's kind of brown instead of orange. Comes back in the window. Customer says it's too spicy, can't eat it. So we need the color. We want to make it look a little sexy. So I'm almost positive that's where paprika came in.
To change the color.
To change the color. And then tamarind went away.
And tamarind is like one of the greatest souring agents of all time.
It's like the god of sour, because there's so many more tones there than just sour. And now it's, some people are just lime sugar or vinegar. I mean, it's just, I'm so like put off about pad thai right now. It hurts, really.
But in a way, what you're doing now at Wazuzu, right, is trying to go back and bring it, bring what it's supposed to be.
I'm so obsessed with it right now that exactly. My pad thai has like three different sours. It's got the tamarind, the lime juice, and the vinegar, because they each do their own thing. And you know, I do admit to hit it with a little paprika, because yeah, I can't hit it with sriracha and I need a little of that pop. So I'm trying to bring it all together and try to find like good pad thai, you know?
What about the noodles? What kind of noodles are they, and how do you prepare them?
So the magic, I mean, like pad thai is two universes brought together, right? First, it's the sauce, which we talked about. It's so many different flavors trying to find that perfect balance. And then it's that noodles where Italians prize the al dente. We prize that they're somewhere between chewy and dry and moist. That I don't know.
Slithery.
Slithery. I like that. Exactly. So it's almost impossible to find the slithery. And there's different tricks one must employ depending on where you're cooking it to find that, I got to tell you. So first, it's a rice stick noodle, first of all. The best is called a chantaboon rice stick. And it's also the same noodle that pho is made with.
Why is that considered the best?
I think it's the way they make this certain rice stick. It's the only rice stick that preserves that chewiness, that slitheriness.
So it's dry. You're not using fresh.
I prefer dry, only because it's readily available. So anywhere in America, you can find really great rice stick. And it actually comes in four sizes. No one knows this. It's by the millimeter. So you get the small, medium, large, extra large. And a good pad thai is a medium. So it should be like 2 to 3 millimeters wide. And so the way to get the slithery, the secret to get the slithery is coaxing out, is almost two steps of cooking. First, you soak it in cold water. And then it starts to absorb moisture, but it's still nice and kind of like tough. It should feel like zip ties, you know what I mean? That kind of tough. And then you need to hit the pan at the right time, let the noodles start to mellow out in the oil, so they're kind of frying. And then once the noodles get a little softer, then it's time to hit them with the sauce, and then they absorb the sauce and then get to that slithery. But at home, it's almost impossible. So here's the trick at home. You have a little mini cauldron of boiling water. The soaked pad thai noodles have to be blanched or boiled just for 2 seconds before they hit the pan, because like 6 to 9,000 BTUs is not going to get you to slithery in the house.
So that's why it's impossible to get it at home. Our heat just isn't hot enough.
And now though that everyone's learned the secret to get to slithery at home, but that's usually the problem.
Mm. So wonderful. Now, what about the condiments, the things that finish off a good pad thai?
The things that finish off all good Thai food is you think in the four flavors, right? I know the Japanese and the Chinese, they think in five or six flavors. But in the Thai, it's the best way to finish off pad thai is to have some nice fresh cut lime, right? And I like Persian lime personally over the key lime, a little sugar. So if you've had a little plate of these four ingredients, you'd be good. A little lime, a little sugar, a little dried Thai chili powder. And the last one is kind of personal. I mean, some people would say fish sauce with chilies. I would say for pad thai, sriracha. Just a little side of sriracha. And then so you give them this kind of base goodness and then let everyone kind of personalize their pad thai before they eat.
I wish you were making it right here now for me.
You know, if we were at Wazuzu, we'd be talking and making pad thai at the same time.
Thank you so much, Jet.
Thanks for having me.
Jet Teela is the chef at Wazuzu in Las Vegas. A recipe for pad thai is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Iced tea and coffee. back in the day, maybe people didn't think so much about the kind of quality that they were drinking. But boy, has that changed. With us today to talk about the best places to find really great iced tea and coffee is Leslie Bala, the Los Angeles editor of TastingTable.com. I hate fruity iced tea. I'm just going to put that out there right now.
You know, I'm with you. I am with you on that. Maybe it's when you get a bad blend, it tastes synthetic and it's overpowering. Like peach iced tea is one of the most just not pleasant things to drink. I think it's really unpleasant. But
and usually when you're drinking iced tea, you're not drinking it by itself. You're drinking it with food. And a lot of times savory food and something fruity, it just doesn't go well together.
Right. To me, iced tea should just be on its own. And I have the perfect place. Fell in love with this place, Tea Salon, which is a new tea boutique, I think, on Melrose at La Brea, right next to M Cafe de Chaya. And they have hundreds of proprietary tea blends that they make. It's actually a company out of New York. I think they have a location at the Chelsea Market. And here, it's a lovely store. It's a really pretty setting. It feels almost like a spa. You can get all sorts of teas, hot, but also cold. What I love about the iced tea is that they have an entire iced tea bar. They have 20 different kinds of iced tea on tap that they...
Oh, how fun!
Isn't it great? They brew them daily. They're kept chilled with pressurized tap systems like a bar, like a beer bar. And you can go in and you can taste some. You can taste what you want. They have all sorts of flavors. They do have fruit ones, but I'll tell you what, I tasted their blood orange and it's really nice. It just kind of tastes bright and citrusy. It tastes natural and it's not sweet and you could put sweetener in it. They have agave syrup on the side and you can do whatever you want to it, but it's so good and so refreshing that you just want to drink it on its own. They had some other flavors too. They had a rooibos blend that had a little bit of coconut, like a subtle coconut flavor. I would never put cream or milk in my iced tea. I don't even put it in my iced coffee generally. But here, with a little bit of cream, it was really lovely and a little creamy and that little coconut, kind of almost tropical. They also have a tea blend. It's a white tea blend, but it's a chai tea blend. So it has like chai spices in it. It tastes creamy even before you add any milk to it. It's really lovely. So much fun. And you can try, like I said, you can sample as many as you want. They'll give you a little taste and you could figure out what you want. But I also love iced coffee. Iced coffee really is my drink.
Is it really?
It is. And I switch. It's like this innate sense in me that as soon as the temperature, there's just one day that all of a sudden I'm drinking iced coffee. It just happens. And most people will make a pot of coffee.
Pour it over ice.
Maybe save it the next day. Pour it over ice again. Stale coffee. It's not great. The best iced coffees, I think, are at some of our, you know, the coffee boutiques like La Mel and Intelligentsia both have spectacular coffee, but they both make really wonderful iced coffee drinks. Intelligentsia, the Venice location and the Silver Lake location have a drink called the Iced Angelino that they did make when they moved out here. It's four shots of their Black Cat espresso that they shake on ice with agave syrup and milk, whole milk. And it is so good. I usually don't drink coffee or sweetener in my iced coffee, and this is just delicious. It's so perfectly balanced, everything about it. It's as if they've figured out the perfect recipe for iced coffee. And this would chain coffee houses have nothing on these drinks. At La Mel, it's almost like a dessert that they have shaved frozen, so they freeze their house coffee and then they shave it, so it's kind of like shards of coffee ice.
It's like granita.
Yes, it's like granita. And then with ice cream on top and the ice, vanilla ice cream, and it melts into the coffee and it all melts and it's kind of crunchy and creamy.
Oh, yum.
It's really good. The other thing La Mel has, though, which I think is really cool, you can get iced coffee brewed tableside, fresh right there, just like they do all of their other wonderful, you know, individual brewing techniques at the Silver Lake Coffee. They call it a coffee boutique, but you can get iced coffee brewed at your table per order. It takes, you know, it's less than 5 minutes, but there's the apparatus. It's by a company called Hario, and it's called the Fretta. And you brew coffee with hot water into a chamber filled with ice. So the hot coffee brews into the ice to kind of stop the heat from creating too much acid and oils, and it comes out really smooth and balanced and fresh. The cool thing is, you can actually buy that for home. It's about $30, and you can use it at home. But then you get away from the fancy coffee places, the coffee houses, and there are some other really interesting iced coffee drinks around town. There's a place in Eagle Rock called Cacao Mexicatessen. It's this really great Mexican cafe, and they have these really fabulous iced mochas. They're kind of earthy. They're just slightly sweet. They use agave syrup. They don't use sugar. There's vanilla and almonds and cinnamon and Oaxacan chocolate and espresso from Mexico, and you can get them spiced with chipotle powder, maybe, so they can be kind of a spicy, chocolatey coffee. Talk about like coffee with a kick, you know? That's really, really wonderful. And then at Café de Leche in Highland Park, they have iced cacao. So this is a Venezuelan drink. In Venezuela, it's like in bags, served in bags with a straw. Here it's in a glass with ice because we are in Los Angeles. Can you imagine Angelinos walking around with bags of coffee, something? You know, I think it'd be really funny. But this is kind of like a kind of slightly gritty. It doesn't have caffeine in it. It's more like an iced mocha, but without really coffee. But it's with milk and toasted and ground cacao, like real, that they grind there.
The nibs. They grind the nibs.
Mm-hmm, and agave nectar. And it's just this kind of sweet, creamy, chocolatey, really refreshing treat. So you can just find these really interesting coffees and mochas around town. And you get away from those appuccinos.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.
That was Leslie Balla, the Los Angeles editor of TastingTable.com. We've been talking about where to go to get great iced tea and iced coffee. What's your summer beverage of choice? I've got a poll up right now on our blog. Iced tea or iced coffee? Vote for your favorite or add your own at kcrw.com/goodfood. And I've got Leslie's recipe for cold brewing iced coffee there, too. Iced beverages are perfect for a hot summer day, and so is gazpacho. I'll be back in 1 minute with Russ Parsons of the LA Times to talk about this cool summer soup. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. This is 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. You're listening to Good Food. I don't have air conditioning, so it can get hot in my house during the summer. The other day, when temperatures were really climbing, I eyed my large bowl of farmer's market tomatoes and I thought, gazpacho. Russ Parsons, food editor of the LA Times, is with me in the studio.
Mmm, gazpacho. You know, it's one of those dishes that it's kind of... what people think of as gazpacho is so remarkably different from what gazpacho really is that I think if people would try like a real gazpacho, they'd fall in love.
It's not salsa.
It is not salsa. Oh, no. And that's such a crime against what they've done is take garnish and make it the dish. Like a real gazpacho, a true Spanish gazpacho is first of all, it's creamy. It's thickened with bread. There's a lot of olive oil in it. So, I mean, you get this really complex flavor. It's not just chopped cucumbers, chopped peppers, and chopped tomatoes.
And the act of pureeing it with the oil and bread makes it a much lighter color. So it's very rare that you see like a super red gazpacho.
Yes. Yeah. And that's actually kind of one way that you can really tell how it's been, if it's been prepared correctly, because a really, a good traditionally prepared gazpacho is almost like a, it's almost like a fiery orange rather than that deep, deep tomato red.
And it's interesting to me because when I started to think about gazpacho and I took a look at the ingredients, you know, the tomatoes, the cucumbers, the peppers, even onion and garlic, this time of year, all those things are at their best.
All of them are at their best. And, of course, the tomato is the basic thing. The other parts, you know, like a little bit of cucumber, a little bit of pepper. But one of the great things about gazpacho is that it's when you think about it, it's really much more of a technique than it is a recipe. You know, there's no Escoffier version of this is what the one true gazpacho must have in it.
When you hand somebody a bowl or a glass of gazpacho for the first time, if they've never had it in this true style before, they're taken aback. They think it's like a smoothie, a drink.
Well, and it looks a little bit like cream of tomato soup, but it's not at all. I mean, it's made with really good tomatoes. It's got a great garlic kick to it. And I find one of the real keys to a great gazpacho is tasting it before you serve it, and it just needs a little bit more acidity. You know, just a shot of sherry vinegar or a shot of red wine vinegar. Not very much, just, you know, like a half a glug, and it can lift it from being, especially if your tomatoes aren't quite as perfect as they might be.
So what is the technique?
The technique is, I mean, it's incredibly old-fashioned, and it's poverty cuisine. It's a bread-thickened soup. And so the first step is to tear up bread and soak it in water. Originally, it was made with a mortar and pestle. I'm not quite that much of a purist anymore. And then you puree you squeeze out the water from the bread. So it's just kind of it's a pap. And you put that in the blender with peeled garlic and puree it. And then you start adding the tomatoes. And you don't need to peel them because it's in a blender. So it's going to, you know, I do try and seed them, though. You know, cut them in half and squeeze out the seeds. So once you've got that puree, then you add whatever else that you want to add to it. So I like a little bit of cucumber and a little bit less green pepper. Just a touch of green pepper really does change it, though. It makes it nice.
Yeah, it gives it a more sort of bracing greenness.
Yes.
That,
yeah,
I think
great description.
That kind of plays off the tomato.
Right, because if it was just tomato, it would be a little bit too simple. I mean, it complexifies it a little bit.
Now, what was the gazpacho in Spain before tomatoes came?
Before tomatoes, it was, as I understand it anyways, before tomatoes, it was an olive oil soup. And the olive oil is a really important part of it. With the blender running, you've already pureed the tomatoes. With the blender running, add olive oil, just like you would if you were making a blender mayonnaise or something like that. You'll know when you've added enough olive oil. I mean, you could measure it if you want. You'll know when you've added enough because the color will change, and it'll go from that tomatoey red to, it's almost, I mean, if you're a sports fan, it's almost University of Texas orange, you know. When it hits that point, then you stop, and then you can stir in some ice water.
And what does stirring in the ice water do?
It just thins it out a little bit because it's a bread-thickened sauce. At this point, it could be very, very thick. And that's actually that's used in Spain as a kind of a dip. It's a vegetable dip.
When it's really, really thick, often it's called salmorejo.
Salmorejo, right.
Oh, I love salmorejo.
And that's delicious, too. So I think of a gazpacho as it's an aesthetic. It's not like there's one way to make it. And then once you get used to it, you can make all different kinds of gazpachos, not only different kinds of tomato gazpachos, but there's, you know, there are white gazpachos that are basically more of a throwback to the old-fashioned. It's bread and garlic and oil.
With a little bit of almonds.
Almonds or pine nuts are really, really good at it.
But only if you find really, really good, nice, long European pine nuts.
Right. But I made gazpacho once. I made a cucumber gazpacho. It was really great. I used the dark peeled cucumber so the color is good, and I treated the cucumber just like I would the tomato. So you start with pureeing the bread and the garlic, add the cucumbers, and then I added yogurt to it, And so it was almost like a raita, but it wasn't because of the bread. It was thick and it was really kind of very suave and very smooth.
Wow. That sounds delicious. Although I do love the kind, the traditional white, that's just the garlic, the bread, almonds, olive oil, and then grapes.
Yes, and half grapes.
Grapes on the top as a
garnish. That's wonderful too. But all of the other things, the things that have come to typify the salsa school of gazpacho, those are things that I like to chop those up and then serve them separately, so that people can actually, like within the aesthetic, they can adjust it to their aesthetic. So it's even more taking it away from the one true recipe to this is a soup that you really tailor to your own taste.
And I've also, on occasion, used stone fruits instead of the tomatoes. So
really?
You have a nectarine or a peach gazpacho.
Do you do that do you serve that as a dessert?
No, as a soup.
As a soup.
Yeah.
Oh, how great.
Yummy.
That's a wonderful idea. Isn't it great to have summer here?
It is. It's so great. It's wonderful. Thank you, Russ.
Thanks for having me.
Russ Parsons is the food editor for the LA Times. I've got his recipe for gazpacho at kcrw.com/goodfood.
Attack of the killer tomatoes. Attack of the killer tomatoes. They'll beat you, bash you, squish you, mash you, chew you up for brunch, and finish you off for dinner or lunch.
That's the theme song from the 1978 film Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Up next, a new solution for growing food in small spaces. Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food. Britta Riley, a Brooklyn native, is pioneering a new approach to urban farming. It's in the window. She's here today to tell us how one can grow up to 25 fresh vegetable plants right in your apartment window. Hi, Britta.
Hi, Evan.
Can you explain window farming?
Essentially, what we've done is we've taken hydroponics and basically resituated them to be vertical and to be very, very space saving and to essentially take advantage of the conditions that you already have in, for example, a New York City apartment where, you have changing seasons, but it's pretty much all year round, nice and just the right temperature in there. And so basically we've made it possible to install one of these hydroponic systems in an array of water bottles that the plants sit inside of and the water runs through the bottles.
Give us a hydroponics 101. How does it work?
So instead of having dirt, you've got some sort of medium that the plant's roots sit inside of. And then you have nutrients, which are, it's basically like a liquefied compost. And you have a pumping system that essentially roots all of that nutrient-rich water directly to the plant's roots. And on a timer, it essentially runs back through the roots and nutrifies the plant.
Give us a visual image of what the window farms that you've developed look like.
So it's a column of, or several columns of water bottles that are screwed into one another. And there's a plant sitting in what's called a net cup in each one of these bottles. And then there's a pipe along the back, and it sends this nutrient-rich water from a reservoir at the bottom all the way up to the top and then trickles down through each one of the bottles.
Do you have to inject a lot of new water into the system constantly, or is it sort of a recirculating system?
Exactly. It's a recirculating system. Basically, you fill it up once every few days and add a little bit of this nutrient solution to it, and then it just runs by itself.
Now, what kind of plants can you actually grow in what is basically a small root environment?
Well, basically, you can grow anything except for root vegetables. So anything where you eat the leaves and branches or it creates a fruit. So you can grow cherry tomatoes, strawberries, kale, chard, lots of lettuces, of course, herbs. My favorites are bok choy and okra.
Wow. Now, I'm curious about this community that you've created that's constantly perfecting the system itself, the growing system itself.
Yes. So basically, this is an open design project. I came up with the first kind of iteration of it and then published those designs on the internet and then have welcomed and created a web platform for all different kinds of people to be able to download the designs, build their own, and then suggest improvements. And through the course of the community building them, discovering different kinds of issues that we run into, and then somebody else suggesting a different solution, we've been able to actually iterate through several different designs. And we're actually about to come out with our third total revised design that's a lot more user-friendly, it's quieter, easier to live with, and much more easy to maintain.
What ends up being so noisy about the system?
Well, it's not really noisy anymore. But before, in kind of our version 2.0, it sounded like Darth Vader was in the room with you, essentially. There's an air pump that actually circulates the water through the system. And when the water would spurt out at the top, it made just a lot of noise. But, you know, people figured out how to make something almost like a gun silencer out of a vitamin bottle. And all of a sudden, we had a window farm silencer.
Unbelievable. It's so interesting. Do plants grow slower, faster, or the same in a hydroponic system as they would in soil?
We find that they actually grow a lot faster, and that's because essentially they are, you're kind of bottle feeding the plant's roots. And so, you know, sometimes people don't want to grow their own plant all the way from seed. And so they'll take a little seedling of some kind and kind of very gently shake the dirt out of the plant's roots and put it into the system. And pretty much universally, we find that all of a sudden the plant's rate of growth increases tremendously. And it starts to develop more robust stems and leaves and branches.
Thank you so much, Britta.
You are very welcome. Thank you for having me.
See pictures of the Window Farm Project at kcrw.com/goodfood. Download past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood. And I really hope you'll enter a pie in the second annual Good Food Pie Contest. Go to kcrw.com/pie to enter. Good Food is produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Jillian Ferguson, Connie Alvarez, and Laurel Garcia. Jennifer Farrow is our consulting producer. Thanks to Gary Messiha and to Ronnie Mickelson. I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.